So we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 8, Text 22. Nama Pankajanavaya. Nama Pankajamaline. Nama Pankajanetraya. Jagraye Nama Pankajanavaya Nama Pankajamaline Nama Pankajanetraya Namaste Pankajangraye Pankajanetraya Namaste Pankajankraye Nama Pankajanavaya Nama Pankajamaline Nama Pankajanetraya Nama, all respectful obeisances. Pankajanabhaya. Unto the Lord who has a specific depression resembling a lotus flower in the center of his abdomen. Nama, obeisances. Pankajamaline. One who is always decorated with a garland of lotus flowers. Nama, obeisances. Pankajanetraya. One whose glance is as cooling as a lotus flower. Namaste. Respectful obeisances unto you. Pankaja Angraye. Unto you, the soles of whose feet are engraved with lotus flowers, and who are therefore said to possess lotus feet. Translation. My respectful obeisances are unto you, O Lord, whose abdomen is marked with a depression like a lotus flower, who are always decorated with garlands of lotus flowers, whose glance is as cool as the lotus, and whose feet are engraved with lotuses. Please repeat. My respectful obeisances are unto you, O Lord, whose abdomen is marked with a depression, like a lotus flower, who are always decorated with garlands of lotus flowers, whose glance is as cool as the lotus flower, and whose feet are engraved with lotus. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Here are some of the specific symbolic marks on the spiritual body of the personality of Godhead, which distinguish his body from the body of all others. Do you remember any of the specific marks which distinguish his body? Anyone remember? One? Yes, but this is giving some specific ones. Anyone? You have just chanted it.
The
Just see how hard it is to control the mind. We chant something, it goes in one and through the space in the middle and out the other ear very quickly. Can anyone look at the board and tell me some of the qualities that distinguish Krishna's body from the body of others? One? His navel is in, it is in like this, like a lotus flower. One, two.
He?
Feet are engraved with lotus flowers. He has the markings of lotus flowers on his feet. Just imagine when we look at, take our hands to a palmist, he looks at lines on our hands and they're all just straight or crooked lines and they're all made up of little broken lines. We have lines on our hands and feet. He has lotuses on his feet, engraved on his feet. And therefore, as Mataji was saying, his feet are considered like lotus flowers. And one more, what else?
Lotus eyes.
Oh, he has lotus eyes, yes. His eyes are like lotuses. They're shaped, of course, lotus petals, you can see, they're very fat at the top, and then they come to a point, and they're very delicate. So his eyes are shaped like that. And one more? Yes, he always wears a garland of lotus flowers. Now, we don't wear garlands very often at all. And when we do, you know, they get a little uncomfortable, like they get a little uncomfortable. And we think, oh, let me take that off. And also the flowers gradually begin to wither. And you think, oh, yes, I've worn this now, let me take that off. Actually, these garlands, they're all the prasad of the Lord. So they're not ordinary also. They're not garlands to honor the person. They're garlands that are given as a gift to the person because they're coming from a sacred personality. Just like, you know, one time, Srila Prabhupada, my mother and my father and I went to visit Srila Prabhupada in the Burnett Street Temple in 1972, I think. Or 74, I'll have to think again. Anyway, we went, the three of us. So it was 72, we went to see Srila Prabhupada. And we sat there, and Srila Prabhupada, in his incredibly elegant, gracious, and yet prideless way, he spoke to my mother and father. He said to my father, he said, "You are very fortunate." He said, "Your daughter will deliver you." And my father couldn't quite understand Srila Prabhupada's English, so he replied, "Oh yes, we always thought she would do something like that." And Srila Prabhupada remained grave. And he said, "Don't think she has given up your service. Don't think she has given up your service." So then he said to my father, he said, "For so many generations back and so many generations forward, will be delivered by her because she has taken to this Krishna consciousness." So my father tried to listen very carefully and respectfully. And my mother was very nervous because she wasn't so happy about this 2-year change that had taken place in my life. So she was listening a little more skeptically. And Srila Prabhupada didn't single her out for attention. Then when it was time to go, they both stood up, I paid my obeisances, and we stood up and were walking to the door in his room, and with one hand, as Srila Prabhupada would do so gracefully, everything he did was just full of the most divine gracefulness. So he took his garland like this with his one hand and over his head, and then he held it like this to his servant and said, "Give it to her," and he indicated to my mother. And so they brought the garland to her. And the garland totally changed her life. She didn't know what to say. She had this garland. She didn't think of it that it had come from a transcendentalist. She just thought it was beautiful. She had never seen something like that. And she was so moved that someone would give her a garland. And she took that garland. It was so significant and so unique and so amazingly beautiful. She kept saying, "Look at all the carnations in that. It's all the way around carnations." I think she must have been thinking, who could expend so much? much money on carnations to make a beautiful garland like this? Because who does? They get up in the morning, sometimes they don't even take a bath. And they dress in their drab black or gray clothes and off they go to work. And they're minimalists. They have the minimal amount of actual beauty in their lives. They're just interested in making money and passion. But here, Krishna, he has no need to make money. He's not a minimalist. He's an enjoyer. He's an enjoyer like none of us could ever, ever, ever try to become. So Krishna wears a garland every day of lotus flowers, beautiful lotus flowers. But perhaps that garland is also a conscious living being. And those lotus flowers are conscious. Because everything to do with Krishna is conscious. It's not just some flowers that he bought at the flower market. But these are actually devotees who are clinging to Krishna's body, wishing never, ever, ever to leave his side. So only Krishna is known, of course, and Krishna's incarnations. But not the average ordinary man doesn't wear a lotus garland to work every day. But Krishna wears one. And his glance is as cool, as we heard. His eyes are like lotus flowers, and his glance is cooling. The Lord may appear as one of us. We may sometimes think, oh, he's a bit more something than I am. I'm pretty good. He must be very good. He's something better than me, like me. But actually, he is always distinct by his specific bodily features. Srimati Kunti claims herself unfit to see the Lord because of her being a woman. Now, this is very politically incorrect. But Srila Prabhupada never minded that. He came to America just when the women's liberation movement was at its peak. The hippie movement and women were now becoming liberated. And no one could say anything that subordinated a woman's intelligence to a man's. And Srila Prabhupada, he never, ever, ever changed his way of preaching because, you see, he was not preaching from the relative times. Now we're affected by the winds coming from the north. And 10 years from now we'll be affected by the winds coming from the south. But Srila Prabhupada wasn't affected by the winds of anywhere. He was speaking according to the position of the Absolute Truth. And according to the position of the Absolute Truth, a woman's body, not a woman, because a woman is a soul, occupying a woman's body, the woman's body is different than the man's. And they would like to say, no, we're the same. And Srila Prabhupada would say over and over again to the women, can a man bear a child? And they would say, that's irrelevant. And they would say, no, can a man bear a child? And sometimes an intelligent lady would understand. And she'd be able to admit, yes, there are some distinctions between men and women, but we're also equal. And then Srila Prabhupada would go on again. And he explained to the ladies, who were not always willing to hear it, that this independence for women was extremely unhealthy. He said, it is a plan of the men. It is the plan of the men. You see, if milk is available in the market, why buy a cow? So they tell you you're independent. But when you have the child, who has the abortion? Who seeks the help of the government to pay for the child? Who has all the anxieties of the children? So men and women are not equal. But still, the less intelligent women would argue that they were. So this is one of the tendencies of today's culture that we should be thoughtful about and we shouldn't take it in the wrong. We shouldn't just follow blindly what modern society wants us to do. Because if we do, we'll be misled. We should hold very tightly to the standards of the Bhagavatam and to Srila Prabhupada's view. Because if we can do that, we can pass through all these various confusing elements and make our way to the spiritual world, where men and women are completely different, but completely equal at the same time, and they're not their bodies. They accept a female body or a male body because that's their loving bhavana, that's how they want to serve Krishna. And that body is it is not composed of material elements. The atomic particles of that body are bhakti love, prema bhakti. The elements, the atomic particles are love. There's no earth, water, fire, air, and ether as separated energies there. Everything there is, every particle there is serving Krishna. And here, everybody and everything is trying to avoid Krishna. And this is the very deep difference between the material world and the spiritual world. And this morning I heard Srila Prabhupada say, and he was speaking to devotees, and he said, Krishna will give you whatever you want. And he said it in a very grave way, not like, oh, that's wonderful, I can get all the things on my list. He said, because he wants you to become completely sure that you can never be happy here. Completely sure of it. So if you've got some other idea, if I had this, if I had this, if I had that, if these circumstances changed like this, if if my family was better situated, if I had more money, if I had more children, if I had less children, if I had a wife that listened to me, if I had a husband who listened to me, if I had this, 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 I would be happier. And Krishna says, you will never be happy here. I have taken my stamp, and I stamped on the material world. This is a miserable place. But if you're so foolish, you think, even though Krishna himself says it's miserable, I'm going to find something out of it. I can make it work well for me. I'm going to have some happiness where he says there isn't any. So what is that? That means that we think Krishna is just like us. You see, so that's called Mayavad, impersonalism. We think that Krishna is like us, everything spiritual is like material. And Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur tells us that the materialized mind is so powerful that it can turn spiritual things into material things. Now that doesn't mean that it can turn spiritual things into material things, but it can turn our perception of spiritual things into mundanity. And we can come in here, and we all know it. We see the deities and we go like this a little bit. We think of a few things we need in our life. We pray, please make everything work nicely for me. Please take away my this or my that. I've got some problem. Please help me to restore and this and that and so on and so forth. We think, and we think in regards to our family or our work or something like that. We make our little prayer for something meaningless, trivial, but important to us because we're very small. So that thing to us is huge. So we pray for that and we walk out and we never, ever, ever understood who the deities are. And we didn't understand who we were. We didn't stop. We were just bustling along with our mundane life, with our mundane mind. And there they are. And so we get a little bit of blessings. And then we think, let me get some blessings on this and blessings on that. And what does it mean to get blessings of a sadhu on something material? It just means, let me intensify my material assets. And so what does Krishna do when we come? He goes like this. He gives you blessings. Sometimes, though, if he's very, very kind, he just thinks, this person is so foolish. So foolish. But this person is also my dear devotee. So I will not give my blessings on what they want. And isn't that a bit scary? Because we're wanting, you know, blessings. And Krishna thinks, I will not give my blessings on this. I will withhold my blessings because this one is wanting something to like. If a child, if your dear child says, Mother, what is this? And you say, that's poison, put it down. And they say, just can I have a little drink? Just a little, just a sip? And they, you say, no, put it down. And they think, gosh, my mother is so mean. So Krishna is like that. He says, put it down. And we say, he's so unfair to me. You know, after all, I'm a nice person, and it's just, I only wanted a little what's the problem? And he's saying, cut! And when he says cut, that is exceptional kindness. We should know this. Because Krishna says himself, and Srila Prabhupada certifies this, that Krishna will never interfere with our independence. That's the one thing he will never do. You see, human beings interfere with each other's independence all the time. Powerful kings, they come into power and they say, okay, I want to expand my kingdom for my own envy and my own pride, so I'm going to fight with that other kingdom, I'll take my armies and I'll expand and expand. And this, as my husband was pointing out, everyone is so proud who comes from the place we now called India. But before 1947, that's not even 100 years ago, there was no such place as India. There was just principalities or kings fighting with each other. My kingdom, his kingdom. And then you know what they all did? If you know your Indian history? Every king would build a temple. If he was a Shivite, he'd build a big Shiva temple. If he was a Vaishnava, he'd build a big Vishnu temple. Temple and palace. And nothing else. All the other houses were simple for so many generations and generations. And therefore there's very little history of India because everything would just deteriorate. What's left is sometimes a palace and mostly only a temple. Because he would take all his piety and all his assets and build something that would last for a very long time. So this is human culture. It comes and goes, it comes and goes, and we fight with each other. But Krishna won't do that to us. He won't invade us. He won't say, you have to surrender to me. I don't care what you think, you have to do what I want. He will never, ever do that. Please note this. Srila Prabhupada has said this so many times. It's so important. Why is it important? Because sometimes we would like him to do that. You know, just take away all my material desires and then I'll be you. No. He says no. Why does he say no? Does anyone know? Why he won't do that?
For our spiritual advancement.
For our spiritual advancement. And what does our spiritual advancement mean?
Love.
Love. So there cannot be love where there's fear. There cannot be love where there's force. There cannot be love in these situations. And Krishna is the supreme autocrat, the topmost personality. And out of love for the jiva, he says, go on your path. First he says, don't do it. The material world is such a dangerous place. My dear son, my dear daughter, please come back to me. You'll be happy with me. I will give you everything. He doesn't ignore you and let you do foolish things. He gives all instruction and all effort. But if you say, I'm sorry, I have to do this, I really want this, he says, do it. He won't interfere with your freedom. So doesn't it become, for us as devotees, a very important question that how do I know when Krishna is like just giving me what I want or if it's what he wants? Because one is different than the other. How do I know? Okay, so somebody is asking this question. Does anyone have any advice for that questioning person? How do I know if it's my desire or his desire? It brings us closer to him, it's his desire, but sometimes we seem so far away that one step closer to him doesn't look very significant. And also one step away doesn't look so significant either. Right? If I'm 100 miles away from Krishna, I take one more step away, it's not a big deal. I'll take that step back later. So how do we know? Yes, there will be characteristics of our taking a step forward. We'll feel some energy to serve and please Krishna.
We could check with Guru Sarvam Shastra.
We have to check. We have to check. This is a very important. What were you going to say, Sarvam?
We put ourselves and our desires at the center. Then we can see that it is about ourselves. Sometimes we don't want to do it, but we have to make the center.
This is a very important point also to see. Ask yourself, is Krishna the center of this? Or am I the center of this? Do I want this because Krishna will be pleased? Or do I want this because I want it? And most people will find, I know Krishna wants me to have it. I know Krishna will be pleased if I have this. So this is why a very good point Guru Bhakti said, you have to be able to be willing to check. And you have to find someone to check with. And you have to find somebody other than your best friend. Don't you think it would be a good idea if I had this? Yes, I guess so. We have to find some authority principle to check when we come beside. Just like, for example, I've noticed this, and I noticed it when Srila Prabhupada was present, that especially when Srila Prabhupada came here and sat here on this Vyasasam, I was very young. I was still in my 20s. So young people in their 20s, they have so many desires and pushings, and they want this immediately and that and so on and so forth. And they're restless and they're urgent. Srila Prabhupada could use that energy, that forceful, youthful energy. But it also sometimes gets in the way because you can't be peaceful enough to listen. And I remember we'd come here to listen to Srila Prabhupada, and my mind would be going on and on whatever I wanted. And we'd all sit here, the temple room would be full of devotees. And I remember sitting right there. My father sat where that mat is, I sat there, and my husband sat there. And we were listening to Srila Prabhupada, and he was so grave. That was the first thing. He was so grave that immediately, first, I felt uncomfortable. Because I was like a rabbit. You know how you see the children when they want to leave the class? They're like as if every nerve in their body is twitching. You know, I had to get out of here. And so as a teenager or a young person, you've also got that, so come in and, oh, he was like immovably grave. Nor did he smile very much. We laugh and giggle and joke and make funny things. He didn't do that. He was so grave. I remember one time he went on a television program in Sydney. And the television announcer was so rude. He was a very materialistic, sophisticated man. And Srila Prabhupada sat there with his young disciples, and he had a look on his face. His lips were down like this. His head was up like this. He had his cane, and he sat there. And he didn't enter into the atmosphere at all. And so the man said at one point, in a nasty way, he said, "You say that all your disciples and yourself are very happy, but you don't look very happy." And he said it in a very rude way. And Srila Prabhupada sat there, looking the same, like this. And he said, "We are happy. Very happy." And then all of a sudden, from nowhere, like as if a very grave moment, he broke into this incredible smile. Like the sun just came out. He just broke into this big smile. And then he became great. It was really wonderful. And all the devotees like went, ah! Because we were so linked to his moods, connected to him. Because he was so transcendentally charismatic. So when he'd sit here, he had that same gravity, deep, deep, and you never knew if you'd ask him anything, what he would say. It wasn't like you go to your parents and say, "Oh, I'll ask my mother if I can do that." You know, she'll sort of say yes or maybe say no. You didn't know what he would say. So you were nervous. So sitting there, and Srila Prabhupada was giving his lecture, and in the same way, and in the class, this is in relation to your point, I would find there were certain things he said that really kind of like pinched me. I felt it like, oh! And then I learned over the years, that's for you. He's given that to you. And it felt like a pinch because he's asking you for a realignment of your consciousness. It's not like he's going around pinching people. Not like that, but Krishna, like a transmitter from within Srila Prabhupada's pure consciousness to your impure consciousness, is tapping on your shoulder. That's for you. Take that. And if you learn, and it's difficult when you're young, to slow down enough to follow these impulses that come from Guru, in this way, because sometimes your guru is not in front of you, so how can you ask him what you need to know? And how can you save your patience long enough to ask him about something that you have to do immediately? But you must learn as devotees to collect these experiences for yourselves to become a good practitioner of Krishna consciousness. So that you know, it will come back to you. Krishna is so kind. Because Srila Prabhupada said, he's kind to you, he'll let you do your nonsense. But, this is the amazing thing, he'll go with you. Whatever you're doing, he'll go with you. Even if you're the worst kind of person, a murderer, a cruel person, a person who's violent and harsh and nasty, who ends up in jail, or even if you become a pig and you wallow around in the gutters, he'll go with you. He'll go with you. And Prabhupada said, what kind of friendship is that? So this is so important. And you see, here's Kunti Devi, and she's seeing Krishna, and he's been with her through so many difficult times. And now things have been resolved. Now the battle is over, the kingdom has been settled, everything is nice now. They have their palace, they have everything in the right place now. And Krishna has his foot on the lowest step of the chariot to leave and return to Dwarka. And Kunti Devi is desperate to keep Krishna with them because she's so elevated. She doesn't care about all those tribulations. And the residents of Vrindavan, they didn't care about the problems. They only cared about Krishna. And this is Krishna consciousness. And this is what it means to become a devotee. And so we have to get through these beginning stages of Krishna consciousness when the mind is very strong and it pulls us back towards matter and it keeps telling us you can enjoy here. You'll be happy, I promise you. We have to say, no, I've read it in the Shastra. Krishna says, step, it's a miserable place. And even if you like it, even if you say, I don't mind, I have a system in my, I have bought this machine and it takes in misery and it converts it into happiness. So I don't mind the misery. I can handle misery. Give me more misery, I'll convert it to happiness. And he says, okay, but it's also temporary. And this is so disturbing. Please understand how it is disturbing to be under the influence of time. Because time is changing everything. Changing, changing, changing. So we're young once, and then we become old. We're happy once, and then we become sad. And in the Chinese culture, which is an elderly culture, an old culture, very similar in that sense to the Indian culture, they know about the cycles. They know there's cycle after cycle after cycle. You know you have a bicycle, right? With two cycle wheels. And they go round and round and round and up and down and up and down. And so in a very wise culture, not this crude modern culture, which is so gross. I can't tell you, Srila Prabhupada said, you should never forget what a horrible place you have come from. And so even if you're born into this society, then you should say, you should never forget what a horrible place you're living in. Because it's so gross. It's all about forgetting anything to do with piety, what to speak of Krishna consciousness, and just getting into it, getting going, getting the new latest this and that and that and this and this and this. And who's totally in the center? You're going to say, me. And I'm going to say, no. The person who's in the center is the industrialist, who's trying to figure out, the businessman, who's trying to figure out how to sell you all these things that you don't need. This is called misplaced intelligence. And every man is thinking, I need money for my family, so there's no problem if I exploit you guys. And the next one is thinking, I need this for my family, so there's no problem if I tell you all the lie. And the politicians are thinking, I need to get that position because I'm, you know, I'll be good in that position. So there's no problem if I tell you it's not lying, it's just campaigning. And it's not lying, it's just advertising. And so therefore, we as foolish living entities with our back to Krishna, we believe so many things that are false. So many things that are false. But Kunti Devi was not like that. She had Krishna right before her. And she's saying, please don't go. And when Narada Muni visited Hastinapur to see the Pandavas, because they are known as Priya, in the level of devotees, higher and higher qualification of devotees. Of course, all devotees in one sense are equal, but to the degree of their absolute giving to Krishna, devotees become considered more and more exalted. So the Pandavas are very high, they're Priya, very dear. And the residents of Vrindavan, what are they? They're Priyotam. They're the topmost Priya to Krishna. So Kunti Devi, when she was visited by Narada, she said, I thought that we were fortunate then. I asked him to stay. He stayed. He was so merciful to us. But now he's gone to the city of Dwarka and he's giving all of his love to the Dwarka Yadavas. So we have nothing. And do you know when Narada came, what Kunti Devi and her sons were doing? They were in the main assembly house. And they were working very seriously. They had a very serious program they were trying to put into operation. And that was, they were trying to figure out how they could manufacture a catastrophe so that Krishna would come back. They were working out, maybe we could tell him this, maybe we could tell him that. What about if we could get this to happen? Something difficult could happen to us and Krishna would come back. Just Krishna would come back. That's all they would think of. So Kunti Devi is saying, I am a less intelligent woman, and it doesn't bother her. She doesn't have any psychological problems by being a less intelligent woman. She is completely loving Krishna in the mood of a very exalted lady, but in the mood of being just an ordinary, less intelligent person, down lower on the social ladder. But actually, she's a very exalted, wonderful devotee who Krishna loves very much. And later she will explain that her love for Krishna is very special. Does anyone know why her love is very special? Her surrender is extremely special. She compares herself to Devaki. So Devaki is the mother of Krishna. She had so many difficulties. Krishna was born in the palace. He was taken away. Devaki had to face Kamsa, who always wanted to kill them. So many difficulties. So she turned to Krishna in all her difficulties. But Kunti Devi said, I had no protection. I had no husband. I had nobody to take care of my sons. I had nowhere to go, only Krishna. So my surrender was even deeper than the surrender of Devaki, who would go to her husband and say, oh, we have a problem, never mind. We would do this, this, and this, and he would advise her, and they would hold together. But I was alone surrendering to Krishna and taking care of my children. So we should learn how to feel like this. We don't make ourselves like this. We are like this already. We're all alone in the material world. Even if we have people around us, we're all alone. We ourselves are the only one in our body, except Krishna. He is there as well. So we ourselves are the only one who knows the difficulties or the pleasures or the ambitions of our particular nature. Except Krishna is there. And he knows everything also because he's your well-wishing friend. And so if you want to make a request to Krishna, as some devotees do, and say, Dear Krishna, I have so many foolish desires. I know you satisfy the desires of your devotee, and I'm very frightened that you might satisfy one of my foolish desires before I become seriously in love with you, and I don't want anything just than to serve you. So please, my first desire that you must satisfy is this. Please don't satisfy any of my desires that will not lead me towards your pure devotional service. This is my first desire. And my second desire is, please gradually or immediately, according to your own divine and perfect will, please relieve me of these desires. Please take them out of my heart. Now you can pray that because it's become your desire. You can't pray it unless it's your desire. Krishna will not satisfy it. But if you desire to desire above your desires, then Krishna must satisfy that desire. So this is how we have to become very clever as devotees and think we're dealing with the most clever. We try to cheat. Oh, they will cheat you. You don't try to cheat. You try to work with his cooperation and beg his mercy. He will give you so much clever opportunities to be protected in this world, which is full of danger, temporary, always changing, and ultimately a very unhappy place. So this is Kunti Devi's prayer. Please, please, I will offer these beautiful prayers like lotus flowers, and please accept them and stay with us. And Krishna did accept them. And he stayed for some months more with Kunti Devi as a result of his beautiful prayers. So read this section. This is a very famous section, the prayers of Queen Kunti. And if you find as you're reading them, there's not enough about you in it, that pinch will come. Oh, that's not right. And your desires are going over here, and Kunti Devi is going there, so it's relevant to me. I have to think about this. Then you try to take that pinch and say, oh, Krishna, here it is again. My big old false ego is bothering me. I want to reduce it. Can you help me? Please. I want to become more and more aligned with the vision and the heart of exalted souls because they know everything about you. Or they know as much as you want them to know. And that is almost too much for them. They have completely enough and they're fully satisfied. I also want to become like that. Please accept me. All right, we'll stop here. If anyone has any questions, they're welcome to ask. Yes, please. Very difficult to pray like that for a conditioned soul because we're spontaneously going to do the other thing. So whenever anyone says I'm praying like that, I always think, oh, they don't know themselves very well because they don't understand how difficult it is. If they understood how difficult it is, they'd understand they must not be doing it because it's so difficult to do. But here's the point. If something's very difficult to do and you try to do it, you need more help, right? So you're already in a little bit of a helpless condition. So if you take your intelligence, instead of going full steam ahead, like a steamroller, you stop and you think, actually, this is very difficult to do, and actually, I'm not able to do this very well, and actually, Krishna can't be pleased with me because I'm just thinking about myself. Those thoughts, they're unpleasant, but they produce, in their essence, they produce a kind of sweetness. Because they produce in us a kind of quality of proper lamentation. If we can learn to take that properly, it will slow us down and we'll feel like, oh my gosh, yes, look at me. And Krishna likes that. Do you like it when your boy is like, he's a little feeling vulnerable and he's trying his best but he's not really doing anything wonderful, but he's got an open, trying feeling? It's natural. So Krishna likes that. And do you like him as much? You can just ask from your intuition, when he thinks he knows everything already and he's doing something that's really not good for him and he's really kind of answering you back and telling you, do you like him as much? So when we know this, we can think, oh, I'm learning something even from my boy about Krishna. Krishna is teaching me something right there. He's teaching me, I'm like this, he probably feels something like that. If I'm like that, he probably feels something like this. But Krishna doesn't have, like we do, this kind of ambition and drive for something on the material plane. He doesn't have that. Because to him, the material world is a prison. But he would like to see those in prison improving themselves. So when you come to him and you can't make the proper prayer, if you stop and think, I'm not a successful da-da-da-da-da-da, I'm a prisoner. What should be the mentality of a prisoner that is going to impress those who placed him in prison because of his inappropriate mentality? What would be the appropriate thing that that person would like to see? And if you, instead of going full force ahead with your prayers, you ponder a little on this, it can shift your mood a lot. And that shift of mood is so valuable. It's almost more valuable than the prayer.
It sometimes.
Yeah.
We pray something and then we feel it's a stupid prayer.
Yeah.
We go back and say, I'm sorry.
Yeah. And the prayer and the sorry apology gets more, you feel more nourished than that prayer. You know, when you make a stupid prayer, what happens is you're just talking to your mind. It's like you're just talking to yourself. You know, if you sit in a room alone and talk to yourself, people think you're stupid. So when you stand in front of the deities and talk to yourself, they also wonder what they think. But you know, standing there going, and then this and there's that and that, and this is really like this and like that, and I this and they that and me this and her that. I'm not, I'm not. The deities go, they bless you. But you come out of it and you think they're not very powerful. They don't really always satisfy my desires. And that's because you didn't really pray properly. When we were at the retreat, my husband gave a very simple example, but it struck me in that way that sometimes something is a gives you a moment of clarity. He was talking about the deaf husband who has a wife, and he's calling his wife. He's talking about how we see the world as we are. See everybody being like us. We only see our own consciousness. So we look at others, we assess them according to only our consciousness imposed upon them. So he gave an example because I was thinking, oh yeah, that's sort of true, but maybe that he gave an example that helped me very much. He said that when the deaf man can't hear his wife, he calls her louder and louder. He's calling, come here. And she's saying, I'm coming. I'll just be a minute, I'm coming. He can't hear that. So he calls again, come here. And she says, I'm coming, in a normal voice. She's not deaf, so she doesn't shout. I'm coming. And he can't hear that. And he says again, come here. And then he's thinking, what is he thinking? He's thinking, my wife is so stupid, she's deaf. She doesn't hear me. So I have to shout louder. She doesn't hear me. And she's thinking, why does he have to shout at me? I can hear what he's saying. So when I transpose that in my mind while listening to the deities in us when we come, or my eyes and me, I think they didn't hear me. So I again offer the same prayer and the same prayer and the same prayer, like they didn't hear me. Because I don't hear them. I don't see their mercy. I'm blind, not and deaf. I don't see, so I say it again and again and again and again and again. And they think, she must be deaf and blind. She doesn't see and she doesn't hear me. Because they do see and they do hear. And they don't have this stigmatism, this disease that all the conditioned souls, all the material embodied jivas have. To see them like us. And as it was saying, Prabhupada was saying so wisely, we think Krishna is a little better than me. He might listen to my prayer. He might fix things up. But maybe, anyway, maybe I better take care of it myself because he might be busy right now or something. So better go do something myself as well. And, you know, I'm Maybe I'll come and pray. I'm pretty busy. I've got so many things I have to attend to. I'll try and put in some time. So then you see, you've got a telescope. What's a telescope supposed to do? What does it do? It brings things that are far away close. Have you ever had a telescope or binoculars and you turn them around the other way? They do exactly the opposite. They put something that the microphone is here, it looks like it's miles away. We don't have the telescope around the wrong way. So we have our consciousness around the wrong way. It's about us, me and mine. It's not about Krishna and his desire, it's about me and my desire. And so Krishna seems a long way away, and my problems seem right there in front of me. And if you turn that telescope around, my problems seem to sort of go, sort of, they vanish a bit. And Krishna seems to fill me with a kind of a joy that I, you know, don't seem to deserve. And we've all had this experience. And we have to become very, very practicing. Practicing doesn't mean I chant my 16 rounds. Of course we chant our rounds. But practicing means, what do I do with my consciousness throughout the day? Do I finish my morning program, and then, as Srila Prabhupada said one time in Los Angeles, I put my bead bag here, and he took his own bead bag and he put it like this on a bookshelf, and violently almost, there he said, I've chanted my 16 rounds and now I can do any damn nonsense I want. My goodness. And he was showing us, don't do this. You have to practice. You have to practice bringing Krishna closer. Turn the telescope around. So this is all very important when we're going to pray. A nice way to pray, Prabhu, if you feel that, you know, it's difficult to pray with Krishna in the center, a very nice way to pray is, before you start praying your prayer, you recite a prayer of somebody who has Krishna in the center. It's very calming and cooling. You can take a prayer of Narottam Das Thakur or Bhakti Vinod Thakur, and they have everything in the right alignment. And if you memorize, you know the bhajans are just prayers. In the Christian tradition, they call them prayers. In the Vedic tradition, they call them bhajans. Because we do bhajan to Krishna, it means the insight. The sadhana is the mechanics. I move my fingers and chant rounds. But the insight is the bhajan. It comes from the power or the feeling for Krishna. And if the insight's not there, you do this tick, 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 tick. And then that's hard using the beads, let's get a little clicker. And if you want to make it really nice, put a little picture of Krishna on your clicker and go click, 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 on your busy day. Done. What's the problem? What's the problem? The problem is, you have to have an interior going on. This is bhajan. So if you want an interior, go to the people who've given us what should go on the interior and read their prayers. And if you do that, if you're that sincere, Krishna will say, oh, this is a very nice person. They actually do want to be in the center. But if we hear so many things and don't have time to do them because I've got so many problems to solve, then Krishna will give you that mentality. Then you're taking the long way there back, and it can be as long as millions of lifetimes, which is to find out if there is anything in the material world that I can enjoy. Krishna says there's not, but there might be. So let me go on with my pursuits. Other people look at it and will argue doubts into our own mind. This is the difficult to stop doing this, isn't it? Difficult to stop doing this. This is what we have to do if we want to become serious, strong devotees. We have to do this. Now, I'm sorry, I cut off your question. I gave you an answer without a question, I'm sorry.
No, I got it.
Yeah. Okay. Alright, if there are any more questions.
Where do they go?
you know, when you have conditions apply on the bottom of an offer. So if somebody is a devotee, but they're not a very advanced devotee, then they get some benefit, certain amount of generations, and there's a certain amount of benefit. But if somebody becomes a very, 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 very elevated devotee, very, very fixed in Krishna, then Krishna takes all of those residents, all the family members, and he takes them also back to the spiritual world.
Not to
Brahmajyoti. And if they're not that, if that person is not that advanced devotee, their parents come up. Liberation is a gradual process also. So they come up, just like I will speak of one devotee I know, and his parents are very highly placed in material society. His mother has an OBE from the Queen of England. And his father was a professor in the university, dean in the University of Psychology. So they were both very, very respected people in their circle. And they were completely atheists, 100%. And the father, his son became a devotee, very serious devotee, and the father, throughout his life, he would criticize, make very, very smart, offensive comments, criticize his son, do so many things, right up until, you'd say, the last day of his life, when he went into a coma. He'd been very sick, getting sicker and sicker and sicker, and so I think maybe 24 hours, maybe 36 hours before he was to leave, the rest of the family, who were also atheistic, they rang their son and said, you should come and see your father, he's about to die. So he came, but he's a very strong devotee. So he came with him with the harmonium. And he sat for the last 18 hours of his father's life, playing harmonium and chanting to him. And he knew that his father would never have allowed this, except that his father was totally in a coma. And in a comatose condition, you still have to listen. So at the very end, Krishna won. And his ashes, which he would never have imagined, actually not his ashes, because his parent and family would never give his ashes, but this devotee took the nameplate that was on the box of his ashes and took that to Vrindavan and embedded it in the sand of the Jamuna underneath the waters on his behalf. So I don't know what happened to him, where he goes next. I can understand where he would have been going normally. But I don't know what happened to him. It's most extraordinary. Even some devotees don't get somebody to chant to them. A very advanced devotee to sit for 18 hours with you and just constantly chant. All the family went their own ways for their own reasons for a little while, went to bed and so on. And he left around 4 in the morning. So throughout the whole night, he heard Krishna's names. So something wonderful will happen to them, you can be sure of that. Thank you very much. So please try and practice something today. Take something that you've heard from the class, something that may have struck you, or something that pinched you a little bit, and do something with it. It's yours. Hare Krishna. Thank you.